What happens when a state governor partners with private citizens on issues of national security? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, June 30th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, political scientists Lisa Hager and David Wiltsy join us for today's Dakota Political Junkies segment. We'll talk about the governor's deployment of National Guard troops assisted by private donors. We'll also look at the former president's upcoming rallies and what they might mean for midterm elections. SDPB's Jacqueline Severin reports on the state's developing medical marijuana program. Brian Gevick has the story of music at the rodeo, plus the art and the artist. We honor the work of Robert Penn. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
And with SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. Good morning. A foundation run by Tennessee billionaires is donating an undisclosed amount of money to send South Dakota National Guard troops to the U.S. border with Mexico. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
Governor Kristi Noem is sending up to 50 soldiers to help secure the border in Texas. She says the president has failed to act while South Dakota and other states are negatively impacted by drug and human trafficking. The cost of the mission is funded by a donation from the Willis and Reba Johnson Foundation. The Johnsons are billionaires from Tennessee who have donated more than $1 million to conservative causes. Ian Fury is the spokesman for Governor Noem. He says the donation is going into the Emergency and Disaster Fund at the Department of Public Safety. Fury says Noem sees no legal or ethical problem in letting a private, out-of-state foundation pay for a South Dakota military deployment.
So Governor Noem welcomes any donations that help alleviate the cost to South Dakota taxpayers.
Fury refused to say how much the Johnsons donated. He says disclosing that information is a security risk because it could help people surmise operational details. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
South Dakota's first medical marijuana dispensary is set to open in Flandreau. The Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe says it will begin selling cannabis July 1st, the day medical marijuana becomes legal in the state. The Sioux Falls Argus Leader reports that the tribe is already accepting applications for medical marijuana ID cards. The tribe's program is independent of South Dakota's new law and the system that the South Dakota Department of Health has until October to launch. The state is also awaiting a court decision on whether recreational marijuana will become legal after its approval by voters last November. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling gives tribal law enforcement authority to search and temporarily detain non-tribal members. The unanimous decision comes from the precedence of a Montana case. Joshua James Cooley was found with illegal firearms and drugs in his vehicle on the Crow Reservation in 2016. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls.
Cooley contested the obtainment of that evidence, arguing that Mr. Saylor, who was a tribal law enforcement officer, he lacked the jurisdiction or the power to detain him once he knew that Cooley was non-Indian.
Thompson says the ruling also confirms the sovereign power of tribal nations.
Of course, the tribal law enforcement officer had jurisdiction to investigate this because he's protecting the health and welfare of tribal members, which is an aspect of sovereignty of the tribe which doesn't rely on a grant of power from Congress.
The Supreme Court ruling prevents local governments from taking power away from tribal law enforcement. And in today's weather, we can expect sunny skies in the west with winds that could gust as high as 20 miles an hour. Sunny skies also in the east with gentle winds. Going into tonight, we can expect mostly clear skies across the state with high winds continuing to gust in the west. We have highs in the upper 80s in the west and southeast with 90s in the northeast and central portions of the state. We have lows in the upper 50s and lower 60s across the board. We can expect sunny skies and high temperatures to continue into tomorrow, with drought conditions persisting across the state. For SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem has announced a private donation that will fund deployment of the South Dakota National Guard to Texas. Their mission, according to the governor's office, is to assist in securing the U.S. border with Mexico. Democratic State Senator Reynold Nessebo represents District 15 in Sioux Falls. I spoke with him this morning. Senator Nessebo, thanks for making time for us today.
I always have time for you, Lori Walsh. Honored to be here.
Let's talk about how you found out about this deployment and the private funding for it from the governor.
Well, yesterday morning, there was a press release from Ian Fury that sent that out. And I was immediately concerned about that and reached out to our legislative staff just to find out whether this had ever been done before, whether this were legal, and to try and get some additional details. As the day went on, it was clear that this was a donation from Willis Robinson or from a foundation that he runs. And I found out from my staff this morning that there was $1 million pledged for this.
And do we know anything about who Willis Robinson is and what his connection to the governor is?
Well, my sense is that he is a conservative Republican who's a fan of Donald Trump. He is not a fan of President Biden. And what I'm concerned about is the role he played in guiding the governor to make this decision. Clearly, she is the commander-in-chief of our National Air and Army Guard. But what's problematic is, did he make any other promises to her? Did he promise to donate to her federal PAC? Has he made contributions to her gubernatorial campaign? And we have to resist. We have to be in opposition to our guardsmen and women ever being used as mercenaries, right? That our guard can never be used as, you know, for political purposes. And that's what it looks like. Whether that's what happened or not, it appears to be politically partisan. And we need to keep our military above that.
Tell me where you found the $1 million donation number. Where'd that information come from? Do you know?
I received that from staff, from my LRC fiscal staff this morning.
So let's talk about the appropriations process, because these National Guards members, once they're deployed, you know, for a state mission, they're state employees as well. So when that $1 million donation comes in, where does it go? How is it tracked? Is it appropriated by the Interim Appropriations Committee? What can you tell us to sort of map the beginning and the end of this fund?
Right. And we would be able to follow this along, that we do have statute that guides if somebody wants to make a donation to the state of South Dakota, there's a way to bring that in. It's also possible that we could take that and plug that into there's a choice of a couple of different funds in the military that we can use to be able to do that. And so the problem from my perspective is that I think this sends a dangerous precedent. The state of South Dakota and our guardsmen, they are not for sale, right? People do not get to call and say, I would like to have this done and I will give you a donation if you do this for me. That's not how we run calling up of our doing a deployment for our guard. The South Dakota state revenue right now is really great. We have at least $50 million more in revenue that were above our budget from what we budgeted. So we have tens of millions of dollars more than expected. We have already appropriated funds for the military for this year, and that does have funds in it, you know, with expected deployments. If there's an unexpected deployment, we can always backfill that expenditure. So we do not need outside funding. And so from my perspective, I would prefer the governor to simply say, we cannot accept this donation. We are fine to do this on our own. And I would feel much better about this deployment than making it look like it's done for partisan political purposes.
Tell me what happens next here. This is not something that's, as you said, the governor is the director of the National Guard. Voters don't vote on those deployments. Lawmakers don't vote on those deployments. Is there any avenue for legislative influence in this decision going forward?
Well, what we could take a look at is the statutes that allow donations to be made and how those donations once made could be transferred. So there could be a conversation about whether this is a good idea or not. My sense, I did see that Representative Aylward also was opposed to this. My sense is that Republicans and Democrats alike are concerned about the dangerous precedent that this would set, that we should not be allowing some wealthy person from out of state who's a clear partisan using our guardsmen in a way that looks like they're carrying out more of a political campaign here than doing what they signed up to do when they agreed to serve as in our Army and Air National Guard.
Democratic State Senator Reynold Nesipa represents District 15, and he joined us this morning from Custer, South Dakota. Thanks, Senator Nesipa. We appreciate your time.
Always an honor. Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, unlocking the details of medical marijuana in the state, SDPB's Jacqueline Severin is with us. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Hallett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Department of Health is drafting rules for the state's medical marijuana program. SDPB's Jacqueline Severin is with us now in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios with an update on Monday's medical marijuana town hall. Jackie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Lots of details coming out as these rules are drafted. So let's start with the marijuana ID card itself and like, who is this for?
Right. Exactly. And so this is in the law. So that's going to affect tomorrow. Who can get a medical ID card? They have to qualify. So they have that the people who qualify have to have a chronic or debilitating disease or medical condition or a treatment of that condition that causes wasting syndrome, severe debilitating pain, severe nausea, seizures, or severe and persistent muscle spasms.
All right. So that is going to have to be the framework with which you even approach your doctor with is this kind of situation in your life. So, and then what? How do you obtain the ID card?
Right. So you have to apply with the state health department, which, you know, their system isn't in place yet. They have to have their system in place by October 29th. But if you qualify, if you have these conditions, so you have to go and see your doctor, see a physician, has to be licensed within the state. It has to be an in-person exam, right? So can't be over telehealth or anything like that. So what basically happens is the physician certifies that you qualify, you have those conditions or a debilitating disease, right? And then they also have to certify that the patient will benefit from using cannabis. So kind of a two-part situation there. So you get that certification, and then you there's some, you know, other details and documentation right. that you apply through the state's system.
Sure. But which, again, you can't do until the end of October.
Right.
So now would be a good time to start a conversation with your doctor, but you know you're not going to end up at that next stage until later in the year. How much is it going to cost?
$100 is the registration fee yearly. Now they have a provision for low income people. So if you qualify as a for low income, you would pay $20 a year yearly. So and that would be 130% of the federal poverty level. To kind of understand that more, if you're a family of three making $28,200 a year or less. So right. yes,
and then you pay for the product.
Yes, and so that it is. You know, it's. State and local taxes then. So mm-hmm. there's not a special tax, but it will be subject to state and local taxes for mm-hmm. the actual cannabis product.
So one of the things we were talking a lot about during the election time was people growing their own product at home. Is that a possibility under this medical
yes.
legislation?
So you can grow your own, but that's also something the physician has to certify. So okay. they could certify that you get the medical ID, but not certify that you get to grow your own. But so that's within the certification form, I believe, or however that's going to, you know, play out. But so you can have, if you are certified to grow, you can have a minimum of three plants. That's like the base recommendation the physician will give is three plants, but they can say, hey, this person should be able to grow more. And they have to give, you know, kind of reasons for that, on that certification, whether, you know, they're too far away, they live in a rural area.
Sure.
Maybe they just need more than what three plants will offer. Things like that. So,
right.
yeah.
So if you're not growing your own, you can't just get it from your neighbor. Where can you?
Right. And so
can
with,
you go to
with
get
this process,
medical marijuana?
Yes. Yeah. The state's also drafting their rules for people who will want to manufacture and produce and sell it, right? And mm-hmm. dispensaries and all that fun stuff. That's also should be in play. The rules for that will be in place by October 29th as well. So right now, you know, there's not going to be any state facilities open to grow, but and you also can't cross state lines, so you can't go to another state and bring it into the state because it's still federally illegal, right?
Sure.
So perhaps maybe you're able to start growing your own. That's one way. There are some, you know, tribal programs that will be opening up across the state on reservations. The Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe will set to be open its first dispensary tomorrow. You have to apply through their program to get a medical ID card through there. So I want to preface that I'm not a legal expert.
Right.
So I think there's still kind of some ambiguity on if you can go there and yeah. cross the reservation lines.
Sure.
If, you know,
there's
the medical ID card
out.
Will be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. there is, you know, tomorrow there is positions and there is, you know, language in the law that says a written certification from a physician will be able to be in place before the state's health department. You can use that possibly. Mm-hmm. You might be able to get away with using the Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe's medical ID, non-resident IDs. Should be able to work as well. So there may be some people that will be able to start right. using it tomorrow. But again, please yes. look at the law.
Yep.
Contact your attorney.
Talk to your physician.
Exactly. Yeah. Talk to your physician, all that stuff.
And to be clear, if you're getting treated at Mayo Clinic or in Denver, those doctors cannot prescribe, or I shouldn't say prescribe at all. We're still learning this language.
But yeah.
yeah. They cannot. That's not going to make a difference for you right now. You're going to have to wait. So
yes.
when do you think that the marijuana for medical use will start being available?
Yeah. So at the town hall meetings on Monday, the state secretary of health, Kim Mulson-Risden, mm-hmm. said likely it probably won't be until next summer, next fall, until somebody can actually get marijuana from a licensed facility here in the state.
So let's go back to this town hall, and it's for the public, and you were there reporting on it. What sorts of issues were people bringing up? What were some of their concerns?
There were a lot of comments. There were a lot of concerns. Some of the top ones were, what if your physician doesn't agree with
sure.
medical marijuana and they won't certify it for you? Again, so I should mention the prescription, because Secretary Molson Risen said several times that they cannot prescribe medical marijuana. They
cannot prescribe it.
They can only certify that you can use it, right? Yeah. So they, you know, and she said, you know, if your physician doesn't agree with it, we're not going to force physicians to certify this. So you may just have to find another physician. That was, you know, interesting. It might cause problems for veterans who get their medical care through the VA because those are federal employees and it's still legal federally. They can't certify. So, you know, she said, if you're a veteran, you may just have to try and reach out to somebody, so another physician in the state that will certify it for you. Right.
Which would not be covered by VA unless you were sent there by VA.
Lots of problems
Yeah, yeah. Puts veterans in a little bit of a bind and a circle.
Yeah.
What else did people say about?
But a lot of people had concerns about the qualifications for getting a medical ID. They were too they say they're too restrictive. That is in the original language. I mean, that wasn't changed from IM-26, which people voted on. So that's what everybody voted on. The State Department of Health does have to have a petition process in place to add to those medical conditions. Their draft rules for that petition process say you have to submit a detailed summary with citations of peer-reviewed research that the treatment with cannabis produces superior treatment outcomes or fewer side effects compared to currently available medications or other interventions.
Yeah.
Part of that process, the petition process, is you also have to get letters of support from two physicians, you know, licensed in the state of South Dakota. So
fascinating stuff. All right. Well, we're going to report much more on this in the future. But tomorrow, by the way, you cannot smoke recreationally in the state of South Dakota.
Right.
That's really important for people to understand that. Because honestly, there's a lot of confusion about that still, which can be surprising because we cover it every, you know, how much coverage have we done?
Yeah.
But for some people who just don't pay that close of attention, they're a little confused. They think it's something they can do. And no.
That issue still be decided in the courts.
All right. And still time to comment.
Exactly.
Still time to
have your voice heard. Have time to comment until July 29th. They're taking email comments at dohcomments@state.sd.us. So you still have time to comment.
All right. You can find more on our medical marijuana coverage from SDPB's Jacqueline Severin on our website, sdpb.org/news. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ahead on the program, the former president returns to the rally. We talk with Dave Wiltsy and Lisa Hager up next. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. What happens when a state governor partners with private donors on issues of national security? Former President Donald Trump hits the trail for public rallies, but to what end? Plus, negotiations around infrastructure could have lasting impact on the Electoral College. Today, we welcome Lisa Hager. She's Assistant Professor of Political Science at South Dakota State University, and David Wiltsey, Associate Professor of Political Science at SDSU and Director of the SDSU Poll. Dr. Wiltsey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hager, welcome as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take these first two topics together because we're looking at President Trump in his first post-presidency campaign rally, or his first post-presidency rally, I should say, in Ohio recently, really kind of, you know, beating the drum about immigration and what his policies were when he was president, how he thinks President Biden is failing. And that ties in with what Governor Noem is saying about her decision to send troops to the Texas border. She doesn't think that President Biden is doing the work that he needs to be done. So let's start with the former President Trump and what these post-presidential rallies are looking like right out of the gate, as we've seen him sort of return into this public arena in an expected but fairly new way. Dave, why don't you start with that?
Well, in a lot of ways, what we're seeing is just kind of a reprise of a lot of the grievance politics that he has used before quite effectively. But, you know, one of the interesting layers to this to me is how he's not picking these places at random. He's, you know, choosing places where there are Republicans, in this case, Anthony Gonzalez, who's a representative from Ohio, who voted against him in the last impeachment vote. So he's really trying to solidify his place within the Republican Party as the de facto leader of the party at this time. So, you know, we're mixing his possible presidential ambitions in 2024. We're seeing this kind of personal grievance that he's taking out on a particular person, and just kind of intermixed with the normal rhetoric that we grew accustomed to over the past 5-6 years coming from.
Yeah. Lisa, Reuters referred to it as revenge endorsements. Is that, that can't be unprecedented in presidential politics, can it? Or is this, are we looking at a sort of new brand or more of Donald Trump's brand? How do you sort of see this in the long term?
Yeah, I see this as something that's relatively new given what happened with the election, where we have Trump putting out this message as if the election was taken away from him or stolen from him and given to Biden in light of all of these questions that he had about the electoral process in a variety of different states. And then we see him, like Dave was mentioning, going out, kind of toying with this possibility of running in 2024, but specifically targeting some of these members of Congress who had voted against him to impeach him. So you have, you know, him going against an Anthony Gonzalez, where he's actually seeking to also boost his opponent, Matt Miller, who's a former Trump aide. So he's being very strategic with the way in which he is, you know, crafting these particular rallies and this tour that he tends to be on currently. So it's not just about trying to get more Republicans into Congress at the midterms and show the Biden administration that maybe they will have a rocky road going forward. It's more about trying to get a particular flavor of Republican in Congress.
So let's intersect this with Governor Kristi Noem and the press release from her office on June 29th about the deployment of National Guard troops to Texas for border security. She says this comes as a response to a request from Texas Governor Greg Abbott. She says, and she doesn't mention former President Trump or a border wall or anything in that press press release, but she does say we should not be making our own communities less safe by sending our police or highway patrol to fix a long-term problem President Biden's administration seems unable or unwilling to solve. My message to Texas is this: help is on its way. And so the big question here, as we sort of pick through some of the what happens at the state level with the, you know, appropriations and compliance with spending of money and donations, but I wanted to ask you two about this broad notion of a governor, a state governor, whether that's Greg Abbott or Kristi Noem, sort of dealing with something like border security, which is a national security issue, without the green light from the president, who is handling it in his administration's own way. Dave, is this an unprecedented sort of foray into this, or is this something governors really grapple with all the time?
You know, I can't recall, governors dealing with, like you said, an explicitly federal issue without the sanction from the president or from Department of Homeland Security or Department of Defense. So in many ways, I think this really is kind of in new ground. And what's just, so off-putting about this to a lot of people is that we really are, seeing kind of a coarse politicization of this issue, and using, our troops as, playing pieces in what really amounts to just kind of a performative political performance. I don't know exactly what their mission is going to be, how it's going to be defined, how might it be bumping up against federal authority, or how it might be used for, state-level law enforcement. But even that has some legal consequences. We're talking about possible violations of the Posse Comitatus Act here. You mentioned the appropriations. I mean, they are opening up a very interesting can of worms from a legal perspective.
And I'm Posse Comitatus Act. Yeah. Tell me what that is.
Well, it's an act that really defines the role of the U.S. military and, by extension, the National Guards of the various states in law enforcement. And it was written largely to restrict the use of federal troops after the Civil War to curtail what was going on with Reconstruction. So there are these very solid limitations within the law as to how our troops can be used. Mm-hmm. So, they have to be reading this thing very carefully because I would suspect that this is going to, if at the very least, really ruffle some feathers within the Department of Defense and the highest levels of our armed forces. And it might even violate the law in some specific instances.
So, Lisa, do you find anything you want to add to what Dave just said? And then also one of the things that I found interesting to watch is at the last rally in Ohio that President Trump's talked about the, quote, woke generals and how they should be focused on defending our nation instead of things like critical race theory and diversity and inclusion. And as you sort of, again, he did not make that connection. But as you look at all these things unfolding, you see all these multi-layers and connections. We're really having some very big conversations in our country about the role of the military, about, the situation at the border, about the role of governors. What would you want to add to that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, at the very basic level, this is obviously a difference of opinion regarding what to do about the border and immigration between Republicans and Democrats. So you have these Republican governors who don't agree with the way in which the Biden administration is handling what's happening at the border. So that's kind of like the basic way of looking at this. But then a variety of the things that Dave brought up, what does this really mean when you have governors being willing to deploy National Guard troops or police to these other states when this is not an issue that they are dealing with. This is a issue that's within the federal government's domain, and really kind of the first thing that I thought when I started seeing the story come out was, one, like, what is really the legality of what is happening here? And also, what kind of precedent does this set going forward? So for me, I was really kind of floored by this whole idea that there was a GOP donor that was funding the deployment of these National Guard troops. That just really seemed unprecedented to me. And the more I dug into it, the more that was supported. And, really legal-wise, that becomes very questionable. Typically, in order to do these sorts of things, you would need statutory authorization for this, which, as far as I can tell and others have been able to see as I was kind of digging into this more, that hasn't obviously happened. And so, it just there's a lot of possible minefields here that are popping up, and I think we're just going to see legal challenges moving forward over this entire issue, both in terms of funding and the states, you know, bumping up to or running over an issue that is within the federal government's domain.
Do you remember either one of you, you know, Blackwater and some of the private companies that were working that got in trouble for, you know, different overseas behavior? Those are contractors and such. And one of the questions I have, you know, these are National Guard troops on a state mission. They're state employees. And what if there's an incident? What if there's an incident at the border? Again, their mission is the details of their mission have not been released, so we don't know exactly where they will be or what they're being. They could be far away from anything that might cause an international incident. But broadly speaking, that's one of the questions you have to ask when something is funded by a private donation. What happens if things, if the mission doesn't go as expected?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that becomes the question is this really a priority when you're not willing to use tax dollars for it, which then I know Governor Noem mentioned how, well, I don't want to use tax dollars. I have this donor who's able to fund this. But, you know, then again, we're sitting here wondering, well, what exactly is the scope of the mission? What are they actually going to be doing down at the border? Which then leads me to speculate whether or not this is just more political posturing. We don't like what the Biden administration is doing. We're going to signal that we don't like that by sending National Guard troops in the case of South Dakota or police for some of the other states to show this, to really kind of rally the base for midterms and then looking forward to the 2024 election.
Right. So, Dave, that gets back to your idea of exactly how are you asking these troops to be used and do they have a real mission and how does that impact you if you signed up to serve your state in your country? And I guess I would throw in as a, you know, a veteran, there were so many times where you're just not sure whether what you're doing is really, really what you signed up to do. So I don't know.
Right.
And it's not unusual to have that thought about what politicians, at least when you're enlisted, every once in a while you have the thought, am I here for a reason?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just, you know, bad optics of this. I mean, we're treating our State Guard as a mercenary force. And I mean, that just doesn't look right in so many ways. I mean, set aside all these important legal issues, the appropriation issues and all that. I mean, is this a precedent we really want to set where someone can, you know, kind of spur and, you know, act, spur action and then fund the deployment of troops in this country? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not a place I really want to go.
Can we just touch briefly before, in like 30 seconds each, perhaps, this whole notion of infrastructure debates and legislation and how that possibly intersects with the future of the Electoral College? Who wants to begin with that one?
Well, as far as the, you know, future of the Electoral College goes, I'll take that. I don't think it's going to go anywhere anytime soon. There's just too many vested interests to upset that particular constitutional provision. And I would also caution about getting too being too certain about whether this infrastructure deal is actually going to pass. We are at the beginning of the negotiation process. We haven't even put real projects and numbers to paper just yet. So
sure.
this is a wait and see scenario here.
All right. We're going to leave it there for today and look forward to talking to you next time. Lisa Hager is Assistant Professor of Political Science at SDSU. Dr. Hager, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Wiltsy is Associate Professor of Political Science at SDSU and Director of the SDSU Poll. Dr. Wiltsy, thank you as well.
Thanks as always, Lori.
Let's take a moment now to not take ourselves too seriously. John Wynn, SDPB's local host of Morning Edition, is moving out of state. His last day with SDPB was Friday. John excelled at clarifying complex topics. He led efforts to analyze COVID data throughout the pandemic, for example. As SDPB staff members gathered to show gratitude, we did what many people do at farewell parties. we shared donuts. This gave SDPB's Josh Heyer a chance to ask for one last journalistic explainer from John, this time on how to eat a donut. Here's John Nguyen.
So first you grab a donut, right? Then hopefully it's jelly-filled. You take a look at the donut, you appreciate everything that it has to offer because, you know, when people say a regular donut, they just think of that, the donut hole-less treat that you get that's fried. But here, this is like a different work of art, right? Obviously, you can tell it's a jelly donut based off of this incision that they put the tube in, right? So the first thing you have to do after appreciating the donut is actually taking a bite out of that hole, right? This is a little introduction, a little tease to what you're going to consume for the rest of this whole endeavor, right? So once you take a bite out of this area here, the goal is to save the best for last. And the best for last is actually the jelly part of that donut. It's not the stuff on the outside, that's just a vehicle for the deliciousness within. So you take a bite out of this part of the donut, then you start to eat around the edges, right? First the right side, then the left. It doesn't really matter. Maybe it depends. I don't know. But you leave this back end to connect the top portion and the bottom portion. The donut will be a little bit flimsy because it's lost integrity on the sides. So what you're going to have to do is that once you reach those points where you've eaten through the side but left this little part open, that's when you kind of just like shove it in your mouth.
That's John Nguyen lightening the mood. Thanks, John. Ahead on the program, the music of rodeo. Brian Gevick has the story. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, the Annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Howlett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
And on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Many things go into making a rodeo an enjoyable experience for all involved, and that includes music. Most events these days feature recorded music, but some say there's no substitute for a live band. SDPB producer Brian Gevick traveled to the Back When They Bucked rodeo in Deadwood for a look and a listen.
No time.
It's a hot Sunday afternoon in Deadwood, and the old wooden grandstand is packed with rodeo fans. They're here for the thrills and spills of a professional Rodeo Cowboy Association bronc riding event.
Here is a horse that so far in 2021 has not been successfully ridden.
Down in the arena, a cowboy on foot pulls on a rope, a gate bangs open, and a big white horse with brown spots and a jet black mane leaps out of the chute, bucking hard and mostly airborne. The bronc rider shows technique, holding on not so much for dear life, but more like there's a lot of money riding on staying in the saddle. Well, horse and rider fight it out, loud music all but drowns out the sound of the cheering fans. Music is live and courtesy of the Barnflies, a South Dakota band based in Flanders. A confronting duo of Casey Wilson and his wife Carlene Wilde, along with bassist Thad Reitz and drummer Eric Blismer, play what amounts to background music during breaks and downtime in the rodeo action. But when a bronc bursts out of the chute, the barn flies play the soundtrack for whatever is about to happen. They call it chase music.
Well, chase music can be any number of things, but it's usually got kind of a steady driving beat, you know, that kind of builds some emotion through the ride or the run, whatever you're doing. Like if you're playing, we were playing for a saddle bronc match there. So you kind of want to start out kind of slow, and when the gates bang, you want everybody to get excited, and that's what you're trying to build, that tension a little bit. And then if he falls off, you kind of do something that might be, you know, dissonant, that doesn't sound well.
Wilson grew up in the Plankinton area and remembers when live music was one of the best parts of the rodeo experience.
We had a local band where I grew up, Kyle Evans and the Company Cowboys. And they were family friends of ours too, and their kids rodeoed with us. And so they played all the local rodeos around there. And that's my earliest musical memories, is listening to those guys.
As to why live bands aren't the norm at rodeo these days, Casey Wilson gets it.
Well, I think that was the easiest thing to cut out for expenses for these rodeo committees, and just hire somebody to run sound, you know, pre-recorded music, and so they've kind of gotten away from it.
Wilson knows how to play music at a rodeo because he knows rodeo.
So I grew up from a rodeo family. My brothers, my mom's side of the family, is from the scenic South Dakota area, south of Wall in the Badlands area, and they're all rodeo people. So I grew up going to rodeos. That's all we knew.
Casey Wilson rodeoed through college at Black Hills State University before going pro. As a pro, he traveled a circuit that took him all over the country for about 15 years.
Probably longer than I should have been.
Wilson specialized in team roping, an event where two galloping riders first toss a rope around the horns, head, or neck of a steer on the run, and then around both back legs.
That was my sole focus in life, is roping, mostly. Team roping is what I did. And, you know, got divorced, and it was hard to go rodeoing with my kids and have them every other weekend and have them the time I did, so I kind of hung that up and picked up my guitar, and that's what I do now, you know.
Casey Wilson and the Barnflies started out by playing roadside bars and small events in the Flandreau area. Playing a big rodeo like this PRCA event in Deadwood is a great opportunity. Wilson knows people who are still into one part of rodeo or another, from the stock growers and outriders to the current pros and the former pros like himself. For SDPB, I'm Brian Gevick.
Thanks, Brian. You can find all our June rodeo coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Now, for our July spotlight coverage, SDPB takes you to summer school. We talk about South Dakota history and heritage, and we get to know the people who preserve, interpret, and teach history to students, to adults, and to people around the world. We want you to be part of that coverage, and we'll start with this question. What is something about American or South Dakota history you wish you had learned in school? Leave us a message at 605-951-0740. You might hear your comments on the air during July. Adept with oils, watercolors, and any other style of art, art making that he pursued, Robert Penn was more than just an artist. He was a person who wanted the Lakota experience to be told. Over the years, his art evolved with his worldview. You can see that evolution at the Dahl Art Center at the exhibition Wokiksoye, a remembrance of Robert Penn. It's being displayed in the Senator Stan Adelstein and Linda K. Clark Gallery. John Gozin Center is an artist and a friend of Robert Penn, and he joins us now with more. John, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, and I still images of Robert Penn's art in my mind from looking at it over these next few days, and I haven't even seen them in person yet.
Well, The exhibition, Wokiksuye, is, you know, what we were already finding out, and its evolution was the largest collection of Bob's work, you know, that's been put together. It's, you know, it comprises of some two collections from the Otka Museum and Larry Pearsall and Vermilion then, and other interested collectors and friends of Bob's that donated their loaned pieces. So, so really, the exhibition itself entails all these different mediums that Bob had mastered. You can see the oils and watercolors and printmaking and silk screening. It's just awesome to see all of that, you know. And it is. I did give a talk at the opening, and I said this may be the last we'll ever see something like this. But
yeah, all
at the end
place.
Of the evening, at the end of the evening, some younger Lakota artists came up and said, "Don't ever say never, John." So I know there's another generation that's been totally inspired by this of Lakota artists. So there's a continuity here, I say.
Will you tell me how you met your friend?
Oh yeah, well we'll have to go back to both Robert and I, Bob, were, you know, went to boarding school. So he went to St. Francis. I went to St. Paul's Indian Mission. So during that time, we were through sports exchanges, I guess, for different school of our schools. Mm. But formally, I guess, to be friends, we met again in the 70s, early 70s. You know, I had already finished my tour of military service and was looking for schooling, and it happened to go to Vermilion. But anyway, that's where I met Bob, and so that was probably back in 1971.
Wow.
Yeah, so quite a history there.
Yeah, and he was a protege of Oscar Howe. Tell us a little bit about how he evolved as an artist.
Okay, well, you know, I have my thoughts about it. There's plenty have been written about it, but I take it in the perspective of Lakota art in itself. But Oscar Howe was really, his work was so imbued in the culture in itself, but so contemporary, you could say modernistic. But Bob, you know, kind of was a protege of Oscar's, and Oscar, I guess, sort of gave him the impetus to be creative on his own, as well as just, you know, studying under him. So Bob is this continuation of this, I'd say this continuum of modern Lakota art, you know. And that's why I see Bob's work as being more than, it's beyond the cliche of Indian art, because it is art that is world art in a sense, you know.
Yeah.
But it's founded in the identity of a Lakota culture, you know. Mm. So it's just that unique, I would say, you know. Has a basis to it then. And it wasn't just all done in a stereotypical manner of the Indian life. It was done in the reality of the Lakota experience of today, you know, of moving beyond the 1800s into the 21st century, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's part of his legacy too now for other young artists. How would you encourage a young artist to experience this exhibition? If you could kind of walk them through, you know, a young Lakota artist especially, walk through this gallery with me and notice what?
Okay, so I've done this already. I've volunteered to be a docent. Anybody wants to get a tour, I'll take them. I like to point out the fact that, you know, there's a strong identity in following a truth about our culture and the self and our history and experience. I like to say that we're a 10,000-year-old culture, and we've been evolving, and then we were severely interrupted in our evolution, but we're back on that creative continuum telling the experiences of the Lakota way of life. You can see Bob is imbued in the culture, but he's really kind of in the present too as well, in the now, I would say, you know, not so much stuck in the past of his history, you know. So I would urge people to understand their culture, their history, their identity in particular, that's going to add to the truth of their art, you know. So that's the way I like to talk about it. It's nothing stereotypical, you know. So and that was one thing Bob always emphasized, that he's an artist. In fact, he'd get a little bit upset about that if somebody thought he was just an Indian artist. And I kind of can relate to that too. So we've had many philosophical discussions, and I know I told Bob, I said, "Well, you're an artist that just happens to be Lakota, and I have to view myself as a Lakota that happens to be an artist."
What did he say to that?
Well, we couldn't argue anymore about that.
Yeah.
but that's the way we see it, is that, you know. You know, a lot of people, they create for the market, in a sense, you know, saleable items. But, you know, Bob's stuff, he just, well, he passed away, not a wealthy man, you know, but his art's indoors. But, you know, so he never, I would say, created for a market, you know, so there's truth into that, you know, what his creativity was all about. And I see our conversations in his pieces and colors and images. And, you know, colors are moods. I mean, you can see all these bright colors and dark colors. You know, that's one thing I try to show people about the truth in this kind of art, you know.
Can you lean in and see the brush strokes, the fingerprint of him as an artist and how close or distant he was from the canvas? Yeah.
Yes, I can. In fact, I own his self-portrait. That was given to me as a gift from one of his earlier acquaintances, and she passed it on to me, and I look at it, and I've seen it. It's been in my studio for a good 25 years or so, but I look at it every day, and I can see the same strokes back when he was a young man in the 70s. And following that style and seeing the just the compositions, the way he puts things together, everything is so recognizable as Bob Penn when you start looking at all the paintings there. There's the theme of the moon. There's the theme of the red-tailed hawk. There's all these images, things that are just so identifiable, you know. And, of course, I knew him personally, so I these things are just a matter of fact that I can just see, you know. Couldn't see it anywhere else, I would say.
We have been talking with Robert Penn's friend, John Gosencenter, from Rapid City. The exhibit is called Wokiksuye. It's a remembrance of Robert Penn, and it's the first time this art has all been together on display at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City. John, what a delight to get to know you and your friend Bob as well. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. Thank you.